Hello, I'm Eben Novi Williams.
And I'm Scott Soschnick. On this weekly podcast, we explore the big money issues in the world of sports and talk to some of the biggest players in the industry. Michael Barr is off.
On this podcast, we speak with Seattle Seahawks cornerback Richard Sherman. But first, let's look at the top stories of the week. A rough week for Jerry Jones, the owner of the Dallas Cowboys, fined $2 million by the NFL for his very public feud with Roger Goodell last year. And there's also some pizza news in there as well.
Yeah, well, Papa John's is out as the official NFL sponsor, and Jerry has, what, 90-some-odd franchises?
Something like that.
Yeah, right. I mean, let's not cry for Jerry Jones. I think he's going to be okay. A few more tours of the stadium at $50-$60 a pop, he'll be just fine. But the fact that this keeps going on, and for a couple of million bucks, and by the way, that's pretty high for the legal fees for what happened, but doesn't the NFL just want this to go away? Can't they work something out behind the scenes that they have to go after publicly that we're going to fine Jerry Jones or try to recoup the legal fees from our fight with Jerry Jones against the commissioner? Just let this go away and focus on football.
It's funny. There's been so much discussion about Roger Goodell's disciplinary power over players. Now he's wielding that over an owner. It does seem as though the fights he's been picking or the fights that have been picked against him certainly in the past couple of years have come from the biggest and most powerful owners in the game. Jerry Jones is certainly one of those. Bob Kraft, the owner of the Patriots, and Roger Goodell have publicly feuded over a number of things as well. At some point, this is going to catch up to Roger, right? I mean, he can't keep angering, fining, publicly feuding with the most powerful guys in his stable.
Well, he's got his new deal, and he says it'll be his last. So he's going to get paid. And he is the commissioner.
You get paid well.
Yeah, but if there's a bold here, Roger doesn't make this move unless he is supported by a majority of the other owners. This is the other owners telling Roger, we got your back. We don't like that he threatened legal action against us. This did not go over well. Jerry didn't do himself any favors in that boardroom when he started threatening his fellow owners. So, you know, we'll see how this turns out. But, you know, Jerry and Roger want to get back to football. But we are going, again, pizza, but basketball. Blaze pizza. What makes this interesting is we know athletes are looking to do other things outside of their sport. LeBron James was an early backer in Blaze. And that company is doing some interesting things.
Yeah, LeBron, a couple years ago, cut his ties with McDonald's, a company that was obviously not going to give him an equity stake, took an equity stake in a young upstart pizza, Blaze Pizza.
I was going to make a really bad joke that they'd give him an equity
slice
nugget or something. Yes, no steak, right. Sorry.
So, yeah, invested a reported $1 million. That's now worth $25 million plus the company itself, $250 million. They're expanding overseas. So LeBron is an endorser of the product. Obviously, he's also an equity holder. And it's a savvy move for him, and it's a great move for Blaze. I was just looking at the Bloomberg software we have. Every time we write about Blaze Pizza, it is LeBron James-backed pizza thing. LeBron cuts ties with McDonald's for pizza. LeBron James-backed pizza chain aims to topple Chipotle.
Well, I think it's fair
every
to say,
single time,
if he wasn't a part of Blaze, we might not even cover it that
exactly
closely.
And would it be expanding into the Middle East right now?
And I wouldn't know the term fast casual. it's just fast food. Right, well, that's interesting that you say the Middle East. First time Blaze is going outside the U.S., and you and I were talking about this off air that, I don't know, London, Paris, something. It's Kuwait. What else is LeBron preparing to do in the Middle East? Mm-hmm. This is going to get very interesting, and his portfolio is going to swell. Going the other way, however, the North American Soccer League.
As a longtime Cosmos fan, I know that you are, this hits you a little harder than
some fans.
I was
one of the guys
fans
who saw Shep Messing and Beckenbauer at Giant Stadium, yes. But they've been having a feud with MLS for some time. It's about official status as a second division team. The long and the short of it is MLS is the dominant player right now. These suits will not be heard in time anyway. And the NASL, for now, is no more. A few of the teams will play in another league that few people have heard of. Have we seen the end of this?
I'm not sure if we've seen the end of it. They say that they are not going away forever. This is kind of a retrenchment. They're going to focus on that antitrust lawsuit they have against MLS. This doesn't affect that necessarily. It might affect the resources the NASL has to continue to fight it and keep lawyers going on it. But overall, I think, why do soccer fans in America care about this? It's just another sign that below MLS, the soccer infrastructure in America is not very good. And we saw this with the United States soccer presidential elections this year. There needs to be a huge change going on. And one of the things that needs to be focused on is the way that lower tier soccer organizations in this country are operated. MLS is backing USL. A lot of their program, their teams have developmental teams in USL. It's clear in this regard that USL has become a bigger property than NASL. But it is so different than the way that soccer operates in almost all the other major soccer countries in Europe, England, Germany, France. There's these tiered leagues. There's relegation. There's promotion. They have vibrant leagues that go six or seven leagues deep within the country, and North America can't seem to support two leagues below MLS. So we'll see where this ends up. Certainly not a great day for U.S. soccer.
That was good by you. You knew a lot right there.
I'm a soccer guy. Now, Scott, let's get into our interview with Richard Sherman.
And the man who's usually on the field and is usually on topic, Richard Sherman of the Seattle Seahawks. Thanks very much for joining us in studio.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate that.
What are we doing in New York?
Mostly gimping around, visiting place to place.
We're on radio here, so we should say you're wearing a walking boot.
Oh, I thought they could see me from the hidden cameras that the government put in. I'm in a walking boot for a few more weeks, thank goodness, when that's over with. But just here on behalf of Cobinhood, a cryptocurrency platform that allows you to trade without any fees, which is, you know, which everybody should be thankful about. So download it, get it right, and get to trading and make some money.
So that's one of the things you're doing. I'm curious, how cognizant are you of capitalizing on all the opportunities that are available to an active athlete because your value is never higher? I've heard Magic Johnson told me, like, when I was done playing, when I came in an office, they'll ask me for an autograph, but if I didn't know what I was talking about, then they'll kick you out.
Right.
Are you cognizant of your value as peak when you're that in the big time sports arena?
Very much so. I think you have to be cognizant to take advantage of it when you're in your prime. You know, just like negotiating the highest contract when you're in your prime playing days. You know, I think some people, you know, you wish you would have negotiated then, and you negotiate later, or your contract extends. I think I'm very cognizant of taking advantage of the opportunities that are presented to me because of the position that I've put myself in with my play on the field, and I guess with some of the things I've done off the field.
And are athletes becoming more savvy in that regard? I was talking to a money manager recently who said that the conversations he has with his NFL clients now are light years ahead, more advanced than the conversations he was having with his NFL clients 10 years ago.
Yeah, because guys have become more aware of being educated, being informed. Things are a lot more available to them. You know, information is available, you know, at the click of a button, click of a link. And I think that guys have seen the horror stories of people going broke, of spending all their money, or our money managers taking advantage of them and trading hundreds of times a day, and they're not making any money, and their money managers making a ton of money. So I think guys have started to be more hands-on with their finances and less reserved and laid back, and, you know, signing away power of attorney and things like that. I think
don't do that ever.
Yeah, it's common sense now, but it wasn't common sense then. And I think guys, I just think the whole landscape is changing in that regard.
So without giving away any secrets, what are you doing? What's your investment strategy? What's the Richard Sherman angle?
Diversify. I'm into a lot of things. I own a few wing stops, own some real estate property, you know, have a few tax-free municipal bonds. You know, I'm in some stocks, you know, the Deutsche Bank, fund, I'm in there. I've at least dipped my toe in just about anything you can dip your toe into. I have equity in a few of the companies that I endorse, such as Body Armor. And you just sit back and wait until they go public and see what happens.
A la vitamin water.
A la vitamin water.
That's the way to go. In the old days, and when I say old days, I mean before I was gray like this, athletes wanted to be rock stars wanted to be athletes. That was the adage. Now, athletes seemingly want to be tech entrepreneurs. They want to be venture capitalists. They're looking to align themselves, and Andre Iguodala was a great example. He's been on this show. He went to Golden State because he wanted to align himself with Joe Lacob and the opportunities in Silicon Valley.
Right.
That's a different way of thinking.
Because, like I said, a lot of these people have grown up hearing the horror stories of athletes going broke, spending all your money, mismanaging your money. And a lot of these guys are competitive, and they're competitive on and off the court or the field or the given playing field that they professionalize in. And they just want to continue to be competitive. You know, this game is fleeting. I mean, you play, you know, in basketball, the most anybody's played is 20 years, I think. And football, I think Tom might be heading to 20 years. But we understand that this part of our lives is limited. It's small, but you can take advantage of it. You can have lifelong connections and lifelong wealth associated with what you did in your playing career. And I think guys are, as you said, more cognizant of taking advantage of those opportunities. And Andre Iguodala going to Golden State for those Silicon Valley opportunities is just another example of that.
You mentioned wealth. It takes a while to maybe understand that there's a difference between I'm making a lot of money, I'm wealthy, I'm rich, versus ownership.
Right.
When did it click for you that there's a different strata? Like, you play for a guy in Paul Allen whose net worth is $25 billion. That's right. With a B.
Right.
That's a whole lot different than I signed a $12 million guaranteed contract and half went to Uncle Sam.
Right, right, exactly. They think money different. They think the world different. And having conversations with people like that, you start to comprehend the way they see the world. And obviously,
well, can you let me in a little bit? Please. Let me into that world a little bit. What is a conversation like between Richard Sherman and Paul Allen?
I mean, when we talk, it's usually about, you know, the trips that he's taken, you know, whether he's celebrating the Chinese New Year or he just came from New Zealand to see the fireworks show. The year we won the Super Bowl, he made it back from I think Australia. He was seeing some cool fireworks show and almost missed the game, the NFC Championship game, because he flew his private jet back because he, you know, kind of slipped his mind. You know, this is just.
I thought you were going to say because Delta was delayed.
No. He definitely doesn't fly Delta. but he did everything he could. He does things. I mean, he spends more money than we'll ever see helping the world, you know, in philanthropy, brain research, things like that he's passionate about. He spends a lot of time scuba diving, which is surprising. he spends a lot less time concerned about his finances than I guarantee all of us.
Yeah, I bet
do.
That's true.
But it's just his mind and his brain works different. I mean, there are a lot of special people in this world who they're allowed to do special things because they think differently. You know, him coming up, you know, them coming up with the idea they did to come up with the company they came up with. I mean, who thinks like that? Who thinks outside of the box like they did? Obviously, there are only a few people in the world who've gotten it done. And I think it's incredible, but I think more people in the world need to step outside of the box, step outside of their comfort zone, step outside of what's normal and what society accepts. And I think there's a special place in that realm.
We're talking with Richard Sherman, a cornerback of the Seattle Seahawks. Richard, let's talk about the NFL. It was a kind of a rough year from a business standpoint from the NFL, as I know you're aware. Ratings were down. Papa John publicly criticizing the league. The players were a lot more active in the protesting race relations. There was a lot going on. Was this a turning point at all? Do you think something fundamentally changed about the NFL this year? The president of the United States obviously criticizing as well. Or do you think it's kind of status quo?
I think it's status quo. I think it's comedy. When a bad year, you were probably still making, you know, $5, 6, 7, 8 billion. You know what I mean?
Keep going. I think you're a little
still,
low on that.
Still low. You know, I'm trying to lowball it just to make the point.
I don't need the phone call from Roger. You should have corrected Richard.
Hey, you should have corrected Richard. You should have corrected him. I mean, they just signed a, what, $4.5 billion deal with Fox for just Thursday Night Football. I think it's a little overblown saying it's you know, it's a bad year, football's down or any in any regard. But yeah, I think it is a turning point with just the athlete in general, understanding how powerful the platform they have is and how many people they can affect and how many people they can reach and affect in a positive way to spur change and to spur conversation. Obviously, Colin Kaepernick, you know, with his kneeling started an incredible conversation. You know, the things that the president said, you know, whether you agree or disagree, you know, are what they are. But I think that the NFL and the players that kneeled and took a stand did something that's powerful and was positive.
But do management and labor view that in the same way? You guys view it, I think, as sort of social activism. Do the owners, when they started hearing criticism and maybe the diminution in ratings, do they look at it as an economic issue?
Not as many as you would think. You know, there are some owners you know, who see things differently than others, obviously, so I can't speak for them, but our owner is very progressive and very forward-thinking and understands that everybody should be treated equal and that people have the right to protest, and especially when you're protesting something that's powerful and life-altering for a lot of people, and we receive nothing but support from him.
Let's keep it in the parlance of business. The NFL is an entity. Let's say it was a publicly traded company. Buy, hold, or sell, and why?
Oh, buy for sure, because the value is always increasing. There's one thing that people, it's like the popularity of the NBA, you know, and the popularity in NFL, and I think the greatest comparison I saw, the most funny to me, was when the NBA All-Star Game. And its ratings, its television ratings, because they say the NFL is so terrible, the Pro Bowls.
Are you going to bring up the Pro Bowl? I knew you were going to the Pro Bowl.
100%, because it's supposed to be the most terrible All-Star game, and nobody ever watches, but the ratings are still above
like 15 million people still tune in.
Right. It's above every other All-Star game and every other sport regardless, because people are going to watch football regardless of what they say about the violence of the sports and the helmet-to-helmet hits and people not playing, et cetera, et cetera. The game isn't going anywhere, and it's only increasing in value.
It's funny you mentioned the NBA. Damora Smith, the NFLPA head, gave an interview this weekend mentioning thought that there were lessons that the NFL could learn from the way the NBA is marketing itself and its media rights. I think the quote he used, the NBA has a fresher, hipper product.
100%.
You agree with that?
I agree wholeheartedly. I agree that they run a better organization than we do from top to bottom. Just think about the way their commissioner talks about their players and supports their players. The situation with LeBron James and Kevin Durant when they were being criticized and told to stick to basketball, you know, which is funny coming from people who are a lot less informed than they are about some of the topics that they have conversations about. You know, I think it's, you know, that's a story for a different day. But I think that the way their commissioner supported them and support the players in their league was admirable. I think you'd have a hard time finding Roger Goodell supporting our players in that way.
Another thing Damora said is that the NBA does a better job marketing its stars.
100%.
It does seem certainly true that the NBA stars are more public in a way that a lot of NFL stars maybe, except for a few minimum, are. How do you guys go about maybe fixing that, doing better at marketing it if you're not getting the support that you feel like you need from the league?
I mean, there's a lot of individuals that go out there, and every individual, you know, Odell Beckham Jr., for example, getting a big deal with Nike, that's him as an individual. That's not, you know, the league kind of pushing him out there.
But is he the smartest guy in the world? The hair, the one-handed catch. I mean, that one-handed catch happened to be a national TV game, so maybe he got lucky. I think it was the Cowboys. Was it against the Cowboys? Okay,
yeah,
even more people. Okay.
Perfect.
I mean, really the perfect scenario to do what he did.
He practiced that one-handed catch.
And he practices it before the games. But it took something like that for it to happen. So OBJ, yeah, becomes this. I see the little kids in the schoolyards wearing OBJ. And it's not just because
right.
New York, because he's cool.
Right.
So how do you become cool?
I mean, it's playing at a high level. Obviously, that one-handed catch wasn't the only thing he does. He plays at a high level pretty consistently. But even quarterbacks like, like Tom Brady, who will go down as probably the greatest quarterback of all time, isn't marketed incredibly by our league. Now, does he have endorsement deals with a number of companies? Of course, because he's a Super Bowl winning quarterback and about to go down as one of the greatest of all time. But our league wants to keep the players kind of nameless and faceless, keep them behind a helmet, you know, because it allows the teams to seem more powerful in that respect and allows people to not gravitate towards players as much, so that when a team says, oh, we got to cut this guy or we got to move on from this guy, that the fans always side with the team. You always hear fans grumbling to players about contracts and things like that. Oh man, you're asking for too much and this and that, but you never hear them complaining when a team cuts a player before his contract is finished. And I think that's the way it's designed. That's the way the teams want it. Like in the NBA, if you have a hard time, well, first off, their contracts, the way they've negotiated them, are guaranteed anyway. So you cut them, you're going to pay them anyway. So there's no need to do that. But you're not going to cut LeBron James. You're not going to just trade LeBron James without incredible backlash. In the NFL, you get less of that because it's more about the logo of the team than it is the players.
Are you okay with the labor contract? Or do you think the players made a mistake in whether it's commissioner power, too much focus on dollars and cents?
I'm fine with it. The commissioner power was something that I think they didn't think that it would get as out of hand as it has. You know, who could anticipate him being a power monger like he has been? I don't think they anticipated him, you know, fining guys $50,000 for plays on a football field that weren't egregious or dirty in any way. I don't think they could have anticipated that. But our salary cap rising to $200 million by the time the next collective bargaining agreement hits, I think is success. I don't think the owners anticipated that. They anticipated the salary cap getting to 135, maybe 140, and they're pretty frustrated with how quickly that it's growing and how much money these players are putting in their pockets.
What would the NFL be? And I'm asking you to be speculative, I know. But what would the NFL be, or what would it become if, and only because he gets so much praise, if Adam Silver was the commissioner instead of Roger Goodell? Is there something more it would be?
Yeah, it'd be a more player-centric, player-driven league. You'd see the relationships between players and ownerships and management would be more amicable than it is at this time. I think you'd see a lot more. The player protests would have been handled a lot differently. I think you would have seen support from the teams and the management instead of the attempt at, you know, I guess suppressing it in some ways. You had some owners that are perfectly fine with it. They understand what the players are standing for, or kneeling for, or sitting for. And then you have some owners who speak about it differently. And you heard that in the ownership meetings, the article that came out, you know, with the way they talk about it. I mean, that relationship, the way some owners see it, still exists. It's a very old line of thinking, but it still exists in some places.
We've got 3 years left, I believe, on this labor accord. When this is up, how big a fight do you expect there to be between players and ownership?
I expect it to be huge. I expect it to be monumental. I think this will be landscape changing because, as you said, players are more informed these days. Players aren't as ignorant and ill-prepared as they were in the first labor fight. I think guys, you know, including the younger players, are more prepared to sit out a season than they were previously. I think that ownership is less prepared. You don't have the $4 billion TV money to just sit back and say, hey, we get this regardless of if a season's played or not. The TV contracts won't be signed until they understand that there's going to be labor peace, so you don't have that security blanket that you did before. And at the end of the day, I mean, do you really want to miss games and lose the momentum that you have going? You don't. So, you know, we'll challenge that and see where they want to take it. Or they'll, you know, agree to what we want to agree to, and then things will go back fine.
Did you just say they were going to agree to what you want?
Right. Or they won't.
Come on.
Exactly. if they don't, then you know, you could easily see a season without football.
What do you want? What? Give me the top two, whether it's health and safety. Give me the top two things. What do you want?
Equality, in some ways. You know, I mean, right now, the 32 owners get more than the 1,500 players in terms of the percentage of the revenue, which is odd.
How do you respond to, and I'm playing devil's advocate, how do you respond to, we take the risk, it's our money? I know it's your bodies. but we take the risk. How do you respond to that argument?
What risk?
The financial risk of shelling out. Let's say somebody's going to buy the Carolina Panthers now. They're going to shell out probably $700, $800 million in cash. Are you saying because it's the NFL and it prints money, there is no risk?
There's no team worth less than $1 billion. First off, and there's no team that makes less than – I'd have to go look at the numbers. I don't want to spew out numbers, but it's been consistent how much money teams make. It's not like there's been volatility in their profits or in their revenue. It's been pretty consistently growing each year. So I think that, you know, that'd be a fool's argument. On top of that, you hear all this about the league caring about player safety and taking care of the players, but – when you talk about having the NBA having lifetime health care for their players, you could not imagine our league having that for their players because they don't really care that much. It's
also,
bottom line.
Also a lot more players.
But you also don't really care that much after they leave the game. The NBA cares about their players. That's why they actually cover them for the rest of their lives. NFL, it's like, after you're done making us money, we'll cover you for, you know, 4 or 5 years, and then good luck.
Well, the nature of the game always seems like it chew you up, spit you out, next.
Right, 100%.
And there's that nameless faceless that works because I don't – who knows the backup tackle?
Right.
Does it matter?
Right. Right, but you get to the point where to the public they say we care about the health and safety of our players. Don't say it if you don't mean it. You know, it's no reason to say it. But actions speak a lot louder than words, and the words are just fluff at this point. It's the league saying – that we care so that public perception is positive, that the public sees them in a positive light and continues to watch the game.
Let's talk about public safety for health and safety for a second. You've been playing football, obviously, for a long time. In that time, there has been a lot of science, a lot of research that has come out about the game. Has anything changed in the time that you've been an adult football player that has made you rethink football, rethink your decision to go into it as a full-time profession?
Not at all. Not at all. Not in the least. And nothing has changed my opinion on whether I'd let my kids play or anything.
So that's a yes.
I 100% let my kids play if that's what they desire to do. You know, it's the right way to play the game. You play the game the right way. You tackle the right way. You usually avoid things like that. You avoid the hits to the head. I've had very few concussions in my career, thank God. And my body, you know, your body gets beat up to a certain degree, but I also make $14 million a year. And, you know, if you told most people they'd take a little bit of a beating for $14 million a year, you'd find them hard-pressed not to take that deal. And I think that the game isn't going anywhere. I think this is an opportunity for a lot of people to attain generational wealth in a way that wasn't available for them before. And for some, wouldn't be available any other way. So as long as this game exists and paying people, you'll have people in line to play it.
Do you see football, because of the concussion risk primarily, becoming sort of a socioeconomic divide? Though, like you said, they would have no other way. Those who need it will play it. Those who don't have to will not.
It already
boxing
is.
Boxing-like?
It's already there?
It's already there. I mean, that's regardless of sports in general a lot of times. I mean, if your parents have money and you come from affluence, there's very rare times that you make it to professional sports. I mean, you may find a couple kids whose parents made six figures growing up, but very few. And that's across the board. That's across any sports. You know, hard work and dedication of these kids, a lot of them come from adverse backgrounds. And I think that'll continue to be the thing.
I don't think all NFL players do. I don't think all athletes do, but you get the entertainment. You've got some John Cena in you. Well, part of the problem in sports is now reaching the kids. Millennials don't have the attention span. They don't want to sit down and watch two and a half. Give me some Richard Sherman ideas for how do we make football appealing to kids.
I think football is one of the more exciting sports because any given play, anything can happen. Obviously, the league has manipulated the rules in a way that makes it more of an offensive game, and people want to see points, so they make it so that there's more points scored.
Says a sour defender.
I mean, call it what you want. I mean, it's obvious. I mean, you don't even need the defense out there anymore at this point. But
that explains the Super Bowl.
Right. It's what's the point? You know, I mean, you play, but I'm not going to go into that. But I think that kids are watching our game more than they're watching a lot of other games. But they're also NFL Red Zone and things like that that are making it easier and more accessible for people to just tune in when there's an important moment or a big play or, you know, teams in a red zone with in scoring position. You know, so you don't have to watch the whole game if you're not interested, because some games are 6-7 or 3-9. And, you know, for an avid fan who likes good defense, it's exciting to watch. But for some of these kids, some of these millennials, they can tune into the red zone.
We're talking to Seattle Seahawks cornerback Richard Sherman. Richard, I want to get your thoughts on the NCAA. As we talk about NFL players not getting a requisite piece of the overall pie, a lot of college athletes are making the claim that they're getting even less. I know it's something you've talked a lot before. You lived it a number of years ago when you were at Stanford. Give me your thoughts on what you think the NCAA, what its future looks like.
I hope it's grim and bleak. Because you could think about it like this. You think about them receiving billions of dollars without having to pay the players. It's the NFL where you're paying the teams and the schools without having to pay the players. I mean, so you got people making millions and millions of dollars who aren't really doing anything. They're doing nothing but punishing kids for transferring schools or punishing kids for are cutting kids for not having the talent or not playing well or et cetera, et cetera. But they'll pay a coach $10 million to go home.
And now we're seeing this bribery scandal with the FBI, which is mostly college basketball
right
now. But kids are in some ways being made the villain here for taking a $70,000 check to go to X university or sign with X manager.
Or take $400. You know, they're killing the kid from Michigan State over $400. I mean, they said they took his parents to a $71 dinner. I mean, what are we talking about here? Are we talking about who's the head of the NCAA and how much does he make and what exactly does he do? You know, how about that scheme and that scandal? I mean, what kind of scheme are they running where they make $6 billion for managing and overseeing tournaments and games and to make sure. The most egregious thing these kids do is, oh, he took $400 or he took $70,000. Well, he could have not gone to college at all and just went to the NFL and got millions of dollars and not having to deal with this. And I think that's the decision that a lot more kids are going to make. You know, they can take the European circuit way, because what's the point of making the NCAA money when you don't have to, when you can just make yourself money?
Football obviously doesn't have the European option. If you look into your crystal ball, what do you think the future is of the NCAA?
I don't know. I mean, they're a $1 billion business, and usually when you make billions, you find a way to manipulate the laws and the rules in your favor. These players are going to have a hard time fighting against money when they don't have any, whether they get a union or not, fighting against billions of dollars when you don't have anything, and you're only in school 3 or 4 years, and there's constant cycling of players. It's going to be tough for them to make a consistent argument, but I hope that they find a way to get these players something. You know, they take their time, they take their energy, they take their money, they take their bodies. There's no lifetime health care for these kids. If you break your neck in college football in a few years, I mean, once they put it back together, they don't care about you. They push you to the side, and now you're dealing with a broken neck for the rest of your life. Hey, you got a great education, a full ride, but you have your C2 and C3 fused together for the rest of your life, and good luck. You know, now you have a pre-existing condition. Good luck getting health care anywhere. And people don't think about that. People don't care about that because they say these kids got a free education. Meanwhile, their coaches are sitting there making $10, $15 million, doing a terrible job, and get fired and get paid to go home. It's like, hey, good luck to this kid with the broken neck. Coach, you did an awful job, but here's $15 million. Go home. We appreciate your efforts.
I brought up John Cena earlier. Curious for your take on the soon-to-come option. Is there a market for the XFL reboot?
There's a market for it, but I mean, people are going soft on the NFL and how physical this game is becoming, I see no market for that, because it's too much of a physical game. They won't have the rules of the NFL, the helmet to helmet, the player safety concerns. None of that will be a concern in the XFL.
But it's going to be safer and more exciting.
In what way exactly? That you know you'll have a hard time selling that. And like I say, people haven't stopped watching boxing.
I want to bring it back to where you began with cryptocurrency. We hear it's a bubble. I mean, this is not a conversation we have every day with the athletes. How should people treat cryptos?
Just like you treat any other investment. Be informed. Do your research. And invest at your own own risk.
I'll say it, risk, yeah.
Yeah, at your own risk. Because there's everything is a risk at this point. I think you have a lot of stock and hedge fund managers that say, man, crypto is a fad. It's gonna bubble. The bubble's gonna pop. But you see the stock market is incredibly volatile right now. People are losing tens of thousands of dollars every day, and nobody's giving them their money back. Nobody's saying, "Hey, well, that's my bad. We judged that one wrong. Here's your money back." You know, they're just saying, "Oh, this is part of the cycle of, you know." So when crypto is doing great, they're saying, "Oh, this is just a bubble." When it's doing bad, they're like, "See, I told you, it's terrible. It's gonna go all to zero."
What is it about cryptocurrencies and athletes that seem to go so hand in hand? I mean, I feel like every locker room I walk into is like video games and cryptocurrency.
yeah, Fortnite and crypto. it's just innovative. It's progressive. It's on the edge. I think a lot of guys are starting to move that direction. Anything that's cutting edge, that seems like it could be the future. And I think crypto could be the future of a lot of things. And I think it's just being fought by money, just like the NCAA. You're not going to change things when big money is already established.
How do you trade or buy cryptos?
Well, I use Robinhood to trade because, you know, you can do it without the fee. I used to use like Coinbase and a lot of other platforms, but, you know, they're cutting into my profits every time I'm trying to trade. I could do 10, 15 trades a day. And
Flyboy's over here.
You know, flying by the seat of my pants. And my profits are getting cut into, so you get an app, you know, like Robinhood that Popo designed, the founder, who's incredibly adept at understanding crypto and blockchain technology in general. Then it really allows you to trade freely, and I can trade right after we get out of here. I'm finishing up a few trades with a few different Bitcoin and Ethereum, and I think it's gonna blow up and boom.
Well, we've been around the world, Richard. Cryptocurrency, Thursday Night Football, Millennials. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you having me.
Takeaways from Richard Sherman, Eben, for me, and I'm always impressed when we sit down with athletes and they can talk about so much more than X's and O's. Not every day we talk cryptocurrencies with athletes, and I know it's sort of something he's doing on the side. He's getting paid to talk. I get it. But he seems to take an interest in it. He seems to really want to understand it. And it's that kind of engagement is what the pro sports unions need. They need players like Richard Sherman who want to get involved, who want to know, who want to delve into detail, who want to take an interest in what the union is doing in the players versus the owners. Because if you're just laissez-faire and you sit back and you're like, somebody else will take care of it, that's why owners so often get whatever they want or a lot in collective bargaining.
And through that business savvy lens, we got a good look at how Richard Sherman views the sport of football and the National Football League. And he said it himself. You heard him. He's bullish on the NFL and pro football as an idea. You know, he would let his kids play. We talked a bit about the health and safety. It's not a huge concern for him. He understands the risks. However, he is not bullish on the direction the NFL is taking right now. He does not appreciate a lot of Roger Goodell's leadership. He believes that there is a lot of lessons to be taken from the NBA. So while he is bullish and would buy NFL in a long term if it were an investment, there is a lot he sees that needs to be cleaned up right now.
My goal is to be the number one pick. That's something I've been dreaming of since a kid.
It feels better to be number one than number five.
I wear the number because of Mike.
We have a chance to go for three in a row.
Good numbers at a good time.
When I first started wearing that number, I was just happy and proud.
Bloomberg Business of Sports, the number of the week.
All right, let's move on to our number of the week, and we're not going to go so hard business here. We're doing feel good. So the number is 34. I'm not going to put you on the spot. But if people have not seen it, a basketball player at Iowa, sophomore, Jordan Bohannon, had hit 34 consecutive free throws. Now, years ago, another Iowa player, Chris Street, had 34 in a row for the school record, and then he was killed in a car crash. So he never got a chance to take number 35. So Bohannon steps to the line, and he intentionally misses so that Chris Street will always be in the record book at 34. Kind of thing we like to see.
It's a great gesture. I ask you the question, if this was the Big Ten semifinal championship game, whatever, if it was an important game and the score was close.
Well, we should say they were up by like seven exactly. or eight with, yeah.
Do we think he does the same thing? How much of this was a product of the situation and how much of this was him deciding that he was going to do a good thing no matter what the game situation was?
Well, it seems he has forged some sort of relationship with the Street family. They were there. So tie game, 1 second to go. I'm not sure. And even the coach said, I didn't know he was going to do it. But I'm going to say I wouldn't be surprised if, no matter the score, no matter the situation, this kid missed the shot. I don't know. I'm just saying I wouldn't be surprised.
Worth noting that he got fouled later in the game, went up and hit both free throws.
And now he'll go to 34 again and have to miss again, and we'll do this in 3 months.
You've been listening to Bloomberg Business of Sports. We're here each and every week at the same time exploring the world of money and sports. I'm Evan Novy Williams.
And I'm Scott Soschnick. Thanks for joining us. Please tune in next week when we speak with the biggest and brightest in the sports business industry.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business of Sports from Bloomberg Radio around the world and online as an Apple Podcast on iTunes.